What is the state of serverless computing and Python in 2024? What are some of the new tools and best practices? Well, we're lucky to have Tony Sherman, who has a lot of practical experience with serverless programming, on the show. This is Talk Python to Me, episode 458, recorded January 25th, 2024. Welcome to Talk Python to Me, a weekly podcast on Python. This is your host, Michael Kennedy. Follow me on Mastodon, where I'm at mkennedy, and follow the podcast using at talkpython, both on bostodon.org. Keep up with the show and listen to over 7 years of past episodes at talkpython.fm. We've started streaming most of our episodes live on YouTube. Subscribe to our YouTube channel over at talkpython.fm/YouTube to get notified about upcoming shows and be part of that episode. This episode is brought to you by Sentry. Don't let those errors go unnoticed. Use Sentry like we do here at TalkPython. Sign up at talkpython.fm/Sentry. And it's brought to you by Mailtrap, an email delivery platform that developers love. Try for free at mailtrap.io. Tony, welcome to Talk Python to Me.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Fantastic to have you here. It's going to be really fun to talk about serverless. You know, the joke with the cloud is, well, I know you call it the cloud, but it's really just somebody else's computer. But we're not even talking about computer. We're just talking about functions. Maybe it's someone else's function. I don't know. We're going to find out.
Yeah, I saw a recent article about server free recently. Somebody trying to move completely. Because as you might know, serverless doesn't mean actually no servers.
Of course. Yeah. Server free. All right. So we could just get the thing to run on the BitTorrent network. Got it. Okay. I don't know. We'll figure it out. But it's going to be super fun. We're going to talk about your experience working with serverless. We'll talk about some of the choices people have out there, and also some of the tools that we can use to do things like observe and test our serverless code. Yeah. For that, though, tell us a bit about yourself.
Sure. So I'm actually a career changer. So I worked cable industry for about 10 years and doing a lot of different things, from installing knock at the door cable guy to working on more of the outside plant. But it just at some point I was seeing limits of career path there. And so my brother-in-law is a software engineer, and I had already started kind of going back to school, finishing my degree, and was like, okay, well, maybe I should kind of look into this. And so I took an intro to programming class. It was in Python, and that just kind of led me down this path. So now, for the past 4 years or so, I've been working professionally in the software world. Started out in a QA role at an IoT company, and now doing a lot of serverless programming in Python these days. Second company now, but that does some school bus safety products. So
interesting. Very cool.
Yeah. Yep. But a lot of Python, a lot of serverless. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, serverless and IoT, I feel like they go pretty hand in hand.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. Another thing is with serverless is when you have very spiky traffic, if you think about school buses that you have a lot coming on, twice a day,
to bimodal, exactly, the 8 a.m. shift and then the 2:30 to 3 shift.
Right. Yeah. So that's a really good use case for serverless, is something like that. So,
mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Are you enjoying doing the programming stuff instead of the cable stuff?
Absolutely. I live in Michigan, so I look outside and look at the snow coming down or these storms, and some people you don't miss being outside. I'm maybe every once in a while, but I can go walk outside on a nice day. And so
you can choose to go outside. You're not made to go outside in the sleet or rain.
Yeah,
absolutely. We just had a mega storm here, and just the huge tall trees here in Oregon just fell left and right. And there's, in every direction that I look, there's a large tree on top of one of the houses of my neighbors. Maybe a house or two over. But it just took out everything that was a cable in the air was taken out. So it's just been a swarm of people who are out in 13 degree Fahrenheit, -9 Celsius weather. Yes. And I'm thinking, not really choosing to be out there today, probably.
Right.
Excellent. Well, thanks for that introduction. I guess maybe we could, a lot of people probably know what serverless is, but I'm sure there's a lot who are not even really aware of what serverless programming is, right? Let's talk about what's the idea, what's the zen of this?
Yeah. So, I kind of, made the joke that serverless doesn't mean there are no servers, but, and there's, hopefully I don't butcher it too much, but it's more like, functions as a service. There's other things that can be serverless too. Like there's, serverless databases or, a lot of different, services that can be serverless, meaning you don't have to think about like how to operate them, how to think about, scaling them up. You don't have to, spin up VMs or Kubernetes clusters or anything. You don't have to think about that part. It's just your code that goes into it. And so, serverless functions are probably what people are most familiar with. And that's, I'm sure, what we'll talk about most today. But, that's really the idea. You don't have to manage the server.
Sure. And that's a huge barrier. I remember when I first started getting into web apps and programming, and then another level when I got into Python, because I had not done that much Linux work, getting stuff up running, it was really tricky. And then having the concern of, is it secure? How do I patch it? How do I back it up? How do I keep it going? All of those things, they're non-trivial, right?
Right. Yeah. There's a lot to think about. And if you like work at an organization, it's probably different everywhere you go too, that they, how they manage their servers and things. So putting some stuff in the cloud kind of brings some commonality to it too. Like you can learn how, the Azure cloud or Google cloud or AWS, how those things work and kind of have some common ground too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Like having also feels more accessible to the developers in a larger group, in the sense that not a DevOps team that kind of takes care of the servers, or a production engineers where you hand them your code. It's a little closer to just, I have a function and then I get it up there and it continues to be the function,
Yeah, that is a different mindset too. You kind of see it all the way through from writing your code to deploying it. Without maybe an entire DevOps team that you just kind of say, here you go, go deploy this. So.
So in my world, I mostly have virtual machines. I've moved over to kind of a Docker cluster. I think I've got 17 different things running in the Docker cluster at the moment, but both of those are really different than serverless, right?
Yeah.
So it's been working well for me, but when I think about serverless, let me know if this is true. It feels like you don't need to have as much of a Linux or server or sort of an ops experience to create these things.
Yeah. I would say like you could probably get away with like almost none, right? Like at the simplest form, like with like AWS, for instance, their Lambda functions, you can, and that's the one I'm most familiar with. So forgive me for using them as an example for everything. There's a lot of different serverless options, but you could go into the AWS console and you could actually write your Python code right in the console, deploy that. They have function URLs now. So you could actually have within a matter of minutes, you could have a serverless function set up. And so,
AWS Lambda, right? That's the one.
Yep.
Lambda being, I guess, a simple function, right? We have Lambdas in Python. They can only be one line. So I'm sure you can have more than one line in the AWS Lambda, but.
Yeah. There are limitations though with Lambda that are definitely some pain points that I ran into. So.
Oh, really? Okay. What are some of the limitations?
Yeah. So, package size is one. So if you start thinking about all these like amazing packages on PyPI, you do have to start thinking about how many you're going to bring in. So, and I don't know the exact limits off the top of my head, but it's pretty quick Google search on their package size. It might be like 50 megabytes zipped, but 250 when you decompress it. To do a zip base, then they do have containerized Lambda functions that go up to like a 10 gig limit. So that helps, but
interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Those ones used to be less performant, but they're kind of catching up to where they're that was really on something called cold starts, but they're getting, I think, pretty close to it not not being a very big difference whether you Dockerize or zip these functions. But yeah, so when you start just like pip installing everything, you got to think about how to get that code into your function and how much it's going to bring in. So yeah, that definitely was a limitation that had to quickly learn. So,
yeah, I guess it's probably trying to do pip install dash R effectively.
To start.
And it's like, you know, you can't go overboard with this, right?
Right. Yeah. When you start bringing in packages, like, you know, maybe like some of the like scientific packages, you're definitely going to be hitting some size limits. So.
Okay. And with the containerized ones, basically you could probably give it a Docker file and a command to run in it, and it can build those images before and then just execute, just do a Docker run.
Yeah, I think how those ones work is you store an image on like their container registry, Amazon's is it ECR, I think, and so then you kind of point it at that, and it'll execute your like handler function when the Lambda gets called. So
this portion of TalkPython to Me is brought to you by multi-platform error monitoring at Sentry. Code breaks, it's a fact of life. With Sentry, you can fix it faster. Does your team or company work on multiple platforms that collaborate? Chances are extremely high that they do. It might be a React or Vue front-end JavaScript app that talks to your fast API backend services. Could be a Go microservice talking to your Python microservice, or even native mobile apps talking to your Python backend APIs. Now let me ask you a question. Whatever combination of these that applies to you, how tightly do these teams work together, especially if there are errors originating at one layer but becoming visible at the other? It can be super hard to track these errors across platforms and devices, but Sentry has you covered. They support many JavaScript front-end frameworks, obviously Python backend such as FastAPI and Django, and they even support native mobile apps. For example, at TalkPython, we have Sentry integrated into our mobile apps for our courses. Those apps are built and compiled in native code with Flutter. With Sentry, it's literally a few lines of code to start tracking those errors. Don't fly blind. Fix code faster with Sentry. Create your Sentry account at talkpython.fm/Sentry. And if you sign up with the code TalkPython, one word, all caps, it's good for 2 free months of Sentry's business plan, which will give you up to 20 times as many monthly events, as well as some other cool features. My thanks to Sentry for supporting TalkPython to Me.
Yeah, so out in the audience, Kim says, AWS does make a few packages available directly just by default in Lambda. That's kind of nice.
Yeah, yep. So Bodo, which if you're dealing with AWS and Python, you're using the Bodo package. And that's included for you. So that's definitely helpful in any of their, you know, transitive dependencies would be there. I think Bodo used to even include like requests, but then I think they eventually dropped that with some like SSL stuff. But you definitely, if you can't just like pip install anything and not think of it, unless depending on how you package these up. So
sure, yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. Of course, they would include their own Python libraries, right?
Like, yeah, you know, and it's not it's not exactly small. I think like Bodo Core used to be like 60 megabytes, but I think they've done some work to really get that down. So
that's not too bad. I feel like Bodo Core, Bodo 3, those are constantly changing, like constantly.
Well, as fast as AWS adds services, that they'll probably keep changing quickly. So.
Yeah, I feel like those are auto-generated maybe. Just from looking at the way the API looks at them, you know, the way they look written. And so,
that's probably the case. Yeah. I know they do that with their infrastructure as code. CDK is all like TypeScript originally, and then you have your Python bindings for it. And so,
right. I mean, it makes sense, but in the same time, when you see a change, it doesn't necessarily mean, there's a new important aspect added. It's probably just, I don't know, people have actually pulled up the console for AWS, but just the amount of services that are there, and then think each one of those has its own full API, like a little bit of the one of those has changed, so we regenerated it, but it might be for some part that you never call, right? Like you might only work with S3 and it's only changed EC2 stuff, right
yep, exactly.
Indeed. All right, well, let's talk real quickly about some of the places where we could do serverless, right?
Yeah,
we've mentioned AWS Lambda.
Yep.
And I also maybe touch on just 1 million requests free per month. That's
getting like jumping into AWS sometimes sounds scary, but they have a pretty generous free tier. Definitely do your research on some of the security of this, but yeah, you can, you know, 1 million requests free per month. You probably have to look into that a little bit because it's, you know, you have your memory configurations too. So there's probably, I don't know exactly how that works within their free tier, but you're charged like,
right.
With Lambda, at least it's your like invocation time and memory and also amount of requests. So yeah, you
know, I'm always confused when I look at that and go, okay, with all of those variables, is that a lot or a little? I know it's a lot, but it's hard for me to conceptualize. Like, well, I used a little more memory than I thought, so it costs, like, wait a minute, how do I know how much memory I used, you know? Like,
yeah, what does this mean in practice? Actually, yeah, it's billed by how you configure it too. So if you say I need a Lambda with 10 gigs of memory, you're being billed at that like 10 gigabyte price threshold. So there is a really cool tool called AWS Lambda Power Tuner. So what that'll do is you can it creates a state machine in AWS. Yeah, I think I did send you a link to that one. So the Power Tuner will create a state machine that invocates your Lambda with several different memory configurations. And you can say, I want either the best cost optimized version or the best performance optimized version. So, and that'll tell you, like, it'll say, okay, yeah, you're best with a Lambda configured at, 256 megabytes, for memory. So, for the link, it's this is Power Tools. This is a different amazing package. Maybe I didn't send you the Power Tuner. I should.
It's news to me.
And they have similar names.
Yeah, there's only so many ways to describe stuff.
Right. Yeah. Okay. They this have it right probably. In their AWS. Yep. Yeah. And it is an open source package, so there's probably a GitHub link in there. But yeah, it this will tell you like the best way to optimize your Lambda function, at least as far as memory is concerned. So really good tool. It gives you a visualization, gives you a graph that will say like, okay, here's kind of where cost and performance meet. And so,
cool.
It's really excellent for figuring that out. At least in AWS land. I don't know if some of the other cloud providers have something similar to this, but it's definitely a really helpful tool.
Sure. Yeah. Like I said, I'm confused and I've been doing cloud stuff for a long time when I look at it.
Interesting things here. So like you can actually have a Lambda invocation that costs less with a higher memory configuration because it'll run faster. So you're, I think Lambda bills like by the millisecond now. So you can actually, because it runs faster, it can be cheaper to run. So
well, that explains all the Rust that's been getting written.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a real number behind this. I mean, we need it to go faster, right? Okay. So, you know, I think maybe AWS Lambda is one of the very first ones as well to come on with this concept of serverless.
Yeah, I don't know for sure, but it probably is. And then, your other big cloud providers have them. And now you're actually even seeing them come up with a lot of, like, Vercel has some type of serverless function. I don't know what they're using behind it, but it's almost like they just put a nicer UI around AWS Lambda or whichever cloud provider that's, that's potentially backing this up. But
they're just reselling their flavor of somebody else's cloud. Yeah.
Yeah. It could be because Vercel, obviously they have a really nice suite of products with a good UI, very usable. So,
Okay. So Vercel, some of them people can try. And then we've got the two other hyperscale clouds, I guess you call them. Google Cloud has serverless, right?
Yep.
Okay. So
I'm not sure which ones they might just be called Cloud Functions. Azure also
Cloud
has.
Run. They got Cloud Run and Cloud Functions. I have no idea what the difference is, though.
Yep. And Azure also has a serverless product. And I'd imagine there's probably like even more that we're not aware of, but it's kind of nice to not think about setting up servers for something. So
something, I think maybe is it FAS? Yeah, function as a service. Let's see.
Yeah,
Yep. But if we search for FAAS as instead of PASS or IaaS, right, there's, we've got Almeida, Intel. I saw that IBM had some. Oh, there's also we've got DigitalOcean. I'm a big fan of DigitalOcean because I feel like their pricing is really fair and they've got good documentation and stuff. So they've got functionless, serverless functions that you can, I don't use these.
Yeah,
but
yeah, I haven't used these either, but yeah. As far as cost, like for, especially for like small, like personal projects and things where you don't need to have a server on all the time, they're pretty nice if you have, a website that you need something server side where you got to have some Python, but you don't need a server going all the time. Yeah, it's
okay. Like maybe I have a static site, but then I want this one thing to happen if somebody clicks a button, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yep. You could be completely static, but have something that is, that one function call that you do need. Yep.
Exactly. Yeah. And then you also pointed out that Cloudflare has some form of serverless.
Yeah, and I haven't used these either, but I do know that they have some type of functions as a service as well. So
I don't know what frameworks or languages they let you write them in there. I use bunny.net for my CDN. It's just absolutely awesome platform. I really, really love it. And one of the things that they've started offering, if I can get this stupid, completely useless cookie banner to go away, is they've offered what they call edge compute.
Oh,
where
okay.
What you would do, I don't know where to find it, somewhere maybe, but basically the CDN has 115, 120 points of presence all over the world where, you know, this one's close to Brazil, this one's close to Australia, whatever. But you can actually run serverless functions on those things. Like, so you deploy them so the code actually executes in 115 locations.
Yes. Yeah.
Or probably Cloudflare or something like that as well, but I don't know.
Yeah. AWS has, they have like Lambda at edge, at the edge. So that's kind of goes hand in hand with their like CDN CloudFront, I believe. Yeah. So they have something similar like that where you have a Lambda that's going to be, you know, performant because it's distributed across their CDN. So.
Yeah, CDNs, that's a whole nother world. They're getting really advanced.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So we won't, maybe that's a different show. It's not a show of today, but it's just the idea of like you distribute the compute on the CDN is pretty nuts. The drawback is it's just JavaScript, which is okay, but it's not the same as
right. Yes. Yeah.
Wonder if you could do PyScript there.
Oh yeah, that's an interesting thought. Yeah. We're like, getting closer and closer to Python in the browser. So
My JavaScript includes this little bit of WebAssembly, and I don't like semicolons, but go ahead and run it anyway.
Yeah.
Out in the audience, it looks like Cloudflare probably does support Python, which is
okay. Yeah. Yeah, there's so many options out there for serverless functions that are really, especially if you're already in, if you're maybe deploying, some static stuff over Cloudflare or Vercel. Yeah, it's sometimes nice just to be all in on one service.
Yeah, it really is. Let's talk about choosing serverless over other things, right? You actually laid out two really good examples, or maybe three even with the static site example. But, I've bursts of activity.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, really focused time, but really, really low, incredibly, incredibly low usage other times, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You think of like, your Black Friday traffic, right? Like you to not have to think of like how many servers to be provisioned for something like that, or if you don't know. I think there's probably some like, I actually know there's been like some pretty popular articles about people like leaving the cloud. Like if you know your scale and exactly what you need, you probably can save money by just having your own infrastructure set up but if you don't know, or it's very like spiky, you don't need to have a server that's consuming a lot of power running 24 hours a day, you can just invoke a function as you need. So,
this portion of Talk Python to Me is brought to you by Mailtrap, an email delivery platform that developers love. An email sending solution with industry best analytics, SMTP and email APIs, SDKs, for major programming languages and 24/7 human support. Try for free at mailtrap.io.
Yeah, there's a super interesting series by David Heinemeier Hansen of Ruby on Rails fame and from Basecamp about how Basecamp has left the cloud and how they're saving $7 million and getting better performance over 5 years.
Yeah. But yeah,
that's a big investment, right? They bought they paid $600,000 for hardware, right?
So yeah. Yeah.
Only so many people can do that.
Right. And you know, you got to have that running somewhere that, you know, with backup power and.
So what they ended up doing for this one is they went with some service called Deft cloud hosting, which is like white glove, labeled is the word I'm looking for, where it just looks like it's your hardware, but they put it
into a mega
data center, and there's, you know, they'll have the hardware shipped to them and somebody will just come out and install it into racks and go, here's your IP.
Right.
Like a virtual VM or a VM in a cloud, but it takes 3 weeks to boot. You
know what I mean? Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is kind of the opposite. It's almost, I'm kind of diving into it because it's almost the exact opposite of the serverless benefits, right? This is insane stability. I have this thing for 5 years. We have 4,000 CPUs we've installed and we're using them for the next 5 years rather than how many milliseconds am I going to run this code for?
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's definitely the far opposite. And so, you kind of, you know, maybe serverless isn't for every use case, but it's definitely a nice like tool to have in the toolbox. And yeah, you definitely, even working in serverless, like if you're, yeah, eventually you're going to need like maybe to interact with the database that's got to be on all the time. You know, it's, yeah, there's a lot of, it's a good tool, but it's definitely not the one size fits all solution. So
yeah, let's talk databases in a second. But for, you know, when does it make sense to say we're going to put this, like, let's suppose I have an API, right? That's an API is a real similar equivalent to what a serverless thing is. Like, I'm going to call this API, a thing's going to happen. I'm going to call this function, a thing's going to happen. Let's suppose I have an API and it has 8 endpoints. It's written in Fast API or whatever it is. It might make sense to have that as serverless, right? You don't want to run a server and all that kind of thing. But what if I have an API with 200 endpoints? Like, where is the point where, like, there are so many little serverless things, I don't even know where to look. They're everywhere. Which version is this one? You know what I mean? Like, where's that trade-off, and how do, you know, you and the people you work with think about that?
Yeah, I guess that's a good, good question. I mean, as you start like, you know, getting into these like microservices, how small do you want to break these up? And so there is some different thoughts on that. Even like a Lambda function, for instance, if you put this behind an API, you can use a single Lambda function for your entire REST API, even if it is, you know, 200 endpoints. So,
So you put the whole app there, and then when a request comes in, it routes to whatever part of your app.
Theoretically, so there's a package called Power Tools for AWS Power Tools.
AWS Lambda
Power Tools for Python. Yeah, I don't get. I know the similar name. Yeah, so they have a really good like event resolver. So you can actually it almost looks like Flask or some of the other Python web frameworks. And so you kind of have this resolver, whether it's, you know, API gateway and in AWS or different, they have a few different options for the API itself. But yeah, in theory, you could have your entire API behind a single Lambda function, but then that's probably not optimal, right? So that's where you have to figure out how to break that up. And so, they do like that same, the decorators, you know, app.post or and your endpoints, and you can do have variables in there where maybe you have like ID as your lookup, and it can, you know, /user/ID is going to find your a single user. So and their documentation, they actually address this a little bit. Like, do you want to do, they call it either like a micro function pattern where maybe every single endpoint has its own Lambda function. But yeah, that's a lot of overhead to maintain. If you had, like you said, 200 endpoints, you have 200 Lambdas.
You got to upgrade them all at the same time so they have the right
data models
and all that. Yeah, that's
right. Gnarly. So yeah, so there's definitely some even conflicting views on this. How micro do you want to go? And so I was able to go to AWS reInvent in November, and they actually kind of pitched this this hybrid. Maybe like if you take your like CRUD operations, right, and maybe you have your create, update, and delete all on one Lambda that's with its configuration for those, but your read is on another Lambda. So maybe your CRUD operations, they all interact with a relational database, but your reader just does like reads from a Dynamo database where you kind of sync that data up. And so you could have your permissions kind of separated for each of those Lambda functions, and you know, people reading from an API don't always need the same permissions as, you know, updating and deleting. And so, so yeah, there's a lot of different ways to break that up, and how micro do you go with this?
Definitely. How micro can you go?
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause it sounds to me like if you have many, many of them, then all of a sudden you're back to like, wait, I did this because I didn't want to be in DevOps, and now I'm a different kind of DevOps.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, that Python, that package, the Power Tools does a lot of like heavy lifting for you. At PyCon, there was a talk on serverless that the way they described the Power Tools package was it, they said it like codified your serverless best practices. And it's really true. They give a lot, there's like so many different tools in there. There's a logger, like a structured logger, that works really well with Lambda. And you don't even have to use like the AWS login services. If you want to use like, you know, Datadog or Splunk or something else, it's just a structured logger, and how you aggregate them is like up to you, and you can even customize how you format them. But it's works really well with Lambda.
You could actually capture exceptions and stuff with something like Sentry, even, right?
And oh, yeah.
Python code, there's no reason you couldn't.
Right, exactly. Yep. Yeah, some of that comes into, you know, packaging up those libraries for that. You know, you do have to think of some of that stuff, but like Datadog.
Yeah,
Datadog, for instance, they provide something called like a Lambda layer or a Lambda extension, which is another way to package code up that just makes it a little bit easier. So there's a lot of different ways to attack some of these problems. So.
A lot of that stuff, even though they have nice libraries for them, it's really just calling a HTTP endpoint, and you could go, okay, we need something really light. I don't know if request is already included, but there's got to be some kind of HTTP thing already included. We're just going to directly call it, not on all these packages. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. This code looks nice. This Power Tools code, it looks like well-written Python code. It's
They do some really amazing stuff, and they bring in Pydantic too. So, being mostly in serverless, I've never really gotten to use like fast API, right? And leverage Pydantic as much, but with Power Tools, you really can. So they'll package up Pydantic for you. And so you can actually, you can have Pydantic models for, validation on these. It's like a Lambda function, for instance, it always receives an event. There's always like two arguments to the to the handler function. It's event and context. And like event is always a dictionary in Python. And so they can always look different. And so, So, cause the event, if you look in the Power Tools GitHub, their tests, they have like, here's what an event
API
from
gateway proxy event.json or whatever, right?
Yes. Yeah. So they have, that's examples. Yes. Yeah. So like, you don't want to parse that out by yourself. So they have, Pydantic models, or they might actually just be Python data classes, but, that you can say like, okay, yeah, this function is going to be for an API gateway proxy event, or it's going to be an S3 event, or whatever it is. You know, there's so many different ways to receive events from different AWS services. So yeah, Power Tools kind of gives you some nice validation. And yeah, you might just say like, okay, yeah, the body of this event, even though I don't care about all this other stuff that they include, the path headers, query string parameters, but I just need like the body of this. So you just say, mm-hmm. okay, event.body, and you can even use, you can validate that further. The event body is going to be a Pydantic model that you created.
Yeah.
So
yeah, there's a lot of different pieces in here. If I was working on this and it didn't already have Pydantic models, I would take this and go to JSON Pydantic.
Oh, I didn't even know this existed. That's very nice. Okay.
Boom, put that right in there and boom, there you go. It parses it all into a nested tree, object tree of the model.
Very
but they
nice.
Already give it to you. They already give it to you. Yeah, then, you know, just take what they give you. But
yeah, those specific events might be data classes instead of Pydantic, just because you don't that way you don't have to package Pydantic up in your Lambda. But yeah, if you're already figuring out a way to package Power Tools, you're close enough that you probably just include Pydantic too. But
yeah,
it's. And they also, I think they just added this feature where it'll actually generate open API schema for you. Kind of, I think, yeah, Fast API does that as well, right? Mm-hmm. So,
right.
Yeah, so that's something you can leverage Power Tools to do now as well. So,
oh, excellent. And then you can actually take the open API schema and generate a Python client for it on top of that, I think. With
Like,
so you just, it's robots all the way down.
Right.
Automated turtles all the way down.
Yeah. 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 I haven't used those open API generated clients very much. I was always like skeptical of them, but in theory you could.
They just feel heartless and or you know, soulless, I guess is the word I'm looking for. And he's just like, okay, here's another KW orgs thing where it's like, couldn't you just like take some reasonable defaults and give me some keyword argument? You know, just like that's always how I feel. But if it's better than nothing, you know, it's better than nothing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So but yeah, you can see like Power Tools, they took a lot of influence from Fast API and
it does seem like it, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. So it's definitely really powerful and you get some of those same benefits.
Yeah, this is new to me. It looks quite nice. So another comment by Kim is tended to use serverless functions for either things that run briefly, like once a month on a schedule, or the code that processes stuff coming in on an AWS SQS, simple queuing service, queue of unknown schedule. So maybe that's an interesting segue into like, how do you call your serverless code?
Yeah. Yeah. So as we kind of touched on, there's a lot of different ways from like, you know, AWS, for instance, to do it. So AWS Lambda has like Lambda function URLs, but I haven't used those as much. But if you just look at like the different options and like Power Tools, for instance, you can have a load balancer that's going to where you set the endpoint to invoke a Lambda. You can have API gateway, which is another service they have. So there's a lot of different ways. Yeah, SQS. So that's kind of almost getting into like a way of like streaming or an asynchronous way of processing data. So in AWS you're using a queue, right? That's filling up and you say like, okay, yeah, every time this queue is at this size or this time frame, invoke this Lambda and process all these messages. So there's a lot of different ways to invoke a Lambda function. So really as simple as you can invoke them like from the AWS CLI or, but yeah, most people are probably have some kind of API around it.
Yeah. Yeah. Almost make them look like just HTTP endpoints.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So Mark out there says, not heard talk of ECS, I don't think, but I've been running web services using Fargate serverless tasks on ECS for years now. Are you familiar with this? I haven't done anything with this.
I'm like vaguely familiar with it, but yeah, this is like a serverless, serverless compute for containers. So, I haven't used this personally, but yeah, very like similar concept where it kind of scales up for you and, you don't have to have things running all the time, but yeah, it can be Dockerized applications. Yeah, in fact, the company I work for now, they do this with their Ruby on Rails applications. They mm-hmm. Dockerize them and run with Fargate.
Docker, creating Docker containers of these things, the less familiar you are with running that tech stack, the better it is in Docker. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like I could run straight Python, but if it's Ruby on Rails or PHP, maybe it's going into a container. That would make me feel a little bit better about it.
Yeah. Especially if you're in that workflow of like handing something over to a DevOps team, right? Like you can say like, here's an image or a container or a Docker file that, you know, that will work for you. You know, that's maybe a little bit easier than trying to explain how to set up an environment or something. So
Yeah.
Fargate's a really good serverless option too.
Excellent. What about performance? You know, you talked about having like a whole API apps like Fast API or Flask or whatever.
Yeah.
The startup of those apps can be non-trivial, basically. And so then on the other side, we've got databases and stuff. And one of the bits of magic of databases is the connection pooling that happens, right? So the first connection might take 500 milliseconds, but the next one takes one. It's already open effectively, right?
Yeah. That's definitely something you really have to take into consideration is like how much you can do. That's where some of that like observability, some of like the tracing that you can do and profiling is really powerful. AWS Lambda, for instance, they have something called cold starts. So the first time like a Lambda gets invoked, or maybe you have, you know, 10 lambdas that get called at the same time, that's going to, you know, invoke 10 separate Lambda functions. So that's like great for the scale, right? That's really nice. But on a cold start, it's usually a little bit slower invocation because it has to initialize. Like, I think what's happening, you know, behind the scenes is they're moving your code over that's going to get executed. And, anything that happens like outside of your handler function, so importing libraries, sometimes you're establishing a database connection, maybe you're, you know, loading some environment variables or some, you know, secrets. And so there's definitely performance is something to consider. That's probably you mentioned Rust. There's probably some more performant like runtimes for some of these serverless functions. So I've even heard some people say, okay, for like client facing things, we're not going to use serverless. Like we just want that performance. So that cold start definitely can that can have an impact on you.
On both ends. That I pointed out, like the app start, but also the service, the database stuff with like the connection.
Right. So relational databases too. That's an interesting thing.
What do you guys do? You mentioned Dynamo already.
Yeah. So Dynamo really performant for a lot of connections, right? But Dynamo is a serverless database that can scale. You can query it over and over, and that's not going to. It doesn't reuse a connection in the same way that like a SQL database would. So that's an excellent option. But if you do have to connect to a relational database and you have a lot of invocations, you can use a proxy. If you're all in on AWS, and so again, sorry if this is really AWS heavy, but if you're using their like relational database service, RDS, you can use RDS proxy, which will use like a pool of connections for your Lambda function.
Oh, interesting.
So that can give you a lot of performance, or at least you won't be, you know, running out of connections to your database. So another thing too is just how you structure that connection. So I mentioned cold Lambdas. You obviously have warm Lambdas too. So a Lambda has its handler function. And so anything outside of the handler function can get reused on a warm Lambda. So you can establish the connection to a database and it'll get reused on every invocation that it can.
That's so cool. Do you have to do anything explicit to make it do that? Or is that just
it just has to be outside of that handler function. So, you know, kind of at your top level of your file. So,
Excellent. Yeah. It makes me think almost one thing you would consider is like profiling the import statement almost, right? And that's what we normally do, but there's a library called Import Profiler that actually lets you time how long different things take to import. It could take a while, especially if you come from not from a native Python way of thinking in like C# or C++ or something. You say hash include or using such and such. Like that's a compiler type thing that really has no cost.
Yeah.
But there's code execution when you import something in Python, and some of these can take a while, right?
Yes. Yeah. So there's a lot of tools for that. There's some, I think, even maybe specific for Lambda. I know like Datadog has a profiler that gives you like this, I forget what the graphic is called, like a flame graph. Yeah. That'll give you like a flame graph and show like, okay, yeah, it took this long to make your database connection, this long to import Pydantic, and it took this long to make a call to DynamoDB, you know, so you can actually kind of like break that up. AWS has X-Ray, I think, which does something similar too. So, yeah, it's definitely something to consider. Another, just what you're packaging, is definitely, something to watch for. And so, okay. I imagined using Pants to package Lambdas, and they do, hopefully I don't butcher how this works behind the scenes, but they're using Rust, and they'll actually kind of like infer your dependencies for you. And so they have an integration with AWS Lambda. They also have it for Google Cloud Functions. So yeah, it'll go through, you say, here's like my AWS Lambda function. This is the file for it and the function that needs to be called, and it's going to create a zip file for you that has your Lambda code in it, and it's going to find all those dependencies you need. So it'll actually, you know, by default, it's going to include like, you know, Bodo that you need if you're using Bodo. It'll if you're going to use you know, PyMySQL or whatever library, it's going to pull all those in and zip that up for you. And so if you just like open up that zip and you see, and especially if you're sharing code across your code base, maybe you have a shared function to make some of these database connections or calls, like you see everything that's going to go in there. And so, yeah. And so how like Pants does it is it's file based. So sometimes just for like ease of imports, you might throw a lot of stuff in like your init.py file and say like, okay, yeah, from, you know, you add all kind of bubble up all your things that you want to import in there. Well, if one of those imports is also using OpenCV and you don't need that, then Pants is going to say like, oh, he's importing this, and because it's file based, now this Lambda needs OpenCV, which is a massive package that's going to it's going to impact your performance, especially in those cold starts, because that code has to be moved over. So
yeah, that's pretty interesting. So yeah, kind of an alternative to saying, here's my requirements or my pyproject.toml, my lock file, or whatever, that just lists everything the entire program might use. This could say, you're going to import this function, and to do that, it imports these things, which import those things, and then it just says, okay, that means here's what you need, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely one of like the best ways that I found to package up Lambda functions. I think some of the other tooling might do some of this too, but yeah, a lot of times it would require like requirements.txt. But if you have like a large code base too, where maybe you do have this shared, you know, module for that, you know, maybe you have, you know, 30 different Lambda functions that are all going to use some kind of helper function, it's just going to go and like grab that, and it doesn't have to be like pip installable. Pants is smart enough to just be like, okay, it needs this code. And so, but yeah, Pants, you just have to be careful. Yeah. Yeah. And there's so many other cool things that Pants is doing that, you know, they have some really nice stuff for testing and linting and formatting. It's, there's a lot of really good stuff that they're doing. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I had Benji on the show to talk about Pants. That was fun.
Yeah.
So let me go back to this picture. Is this the picture? I have a lot of things open on my screen now. There. So on my server setup that I described, which is a bunch of Docker containers running on one big machine, I can go in there and I can say, tail this log and see all the traffic to all the different containers. I can tail another log and just see like the logging, logbook, log guru, whatever output of that, or just the web traffic. Like there's different ways to just go, I'm just going to sit back and look at it for a minute, make sure it's chilling, right? If everything's so transient, not so easy in the same way. So what do you do?
Yeah. So, yeah, Power Tools does, they have their structured logger that helps a lot. But yeah, you have to kind of like aggregate these logs somewhere, right? Because yeah, you can't, you know, a Lambda function, you can't like SSH into, right? So,
yeah, you can't, it's running too long.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, you need to have some way to aggregate these. So like AWS has CloudWatch, where that will like by default kind of log all of your standard out. So even like a print statement would go to CloudWatch just by default. But you probably want to like structure these better with most likely in you know JSON format. Just most tooling around those is going to help you. So yeah, the PowerTools structured logger is really good, and you can even like you can have like a single log statement, but you can append different keys to it. And it's pretty powerful, especially because you don't want to like, I think like, so if you just like printed something in a Lambda function, for instance, that's going to be like a different row on each of your like by like the default CloudWatch, like it'll be how it breaks it up is really odd unless you have some kind of structure to them.
Okay.
And so, yeah, so definitely something to consider. Something else you can do is, yeah, there's metrics you can do. So like how it works with like CloudWatch, they have a specific format. And if you use that format, you can, it'll automatically pull that in as a metric. And like Datadog has something similar where you can actually kind of like go in there. You can look at your logs and say like find a value and be like, I want this to be a metric now. And yeah, so that's really powerful.
Oh, the metric sounds cool. So I see login and tracing. What's the difference between those things? Like to me, like, tracing is a level and just a high level of logging.
Yeah, tracing. And hopefully I do the justice differentiating the two. I feel like tracing does have a lot more to do with your performance, or maybe even closer to like tracking some of these metrics, right? I've used the Datadog tracer a lot, and I've used the AWS like X-ray their tracing utility a little bit too, and so like those will show you. So like maybe you are reaching out to a database, writing
almost
to
like
S3.
APM application performance monitoring, where it says
yes,
you spent this much time in a SQL query and this much time in Pydantic serialization, whereas the logging would say a user has been sent a message.
Right, exactly. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Yep. Tracing definitely is probably more around your performance and things like that.
So it's kind of insane that they can do that. You know, you see it in the Django debug toolbar and the Pyramid debug toolbar, but they'll be like, here's your code and here's all your SQL queries and here's how long they took. And you're just like, wow, that thing's reaching deep down in there, you know?
The Datadog one is very interesting because like it just knows like that this is a SQL connection, and it tells you like, oh, okay, this SQL connection took this long. And it's like, I didn't tell it to even trace that. Like it just like, it knows really well. Yeah. So like
one thing to know a SQL connection's open is another to say, and here's what it sent over SSL, by the way. Like, how'd you get in there?
Yeah. So
it's in process, so it can do a lot. Right. So it is impressive to see those things at work. All right. So that's probably what the tracing is about, right?
Yes. Yeah. Definitely probably more around performance. You can put some different things in tracing too. Like I've used it to say like, we talked about those like database connections to say like, oh yeah, this is reusing a connection here. Cause I was trying to like debug some stuff on, am I creating a connection too many times? So I don't want to be. So yeah, you can put some other useful things in tracing as well. But
yeah. And pat out in the audience. Oops, move around. When using many microservices, like single execution involves many services, basically, it's hard to follow the logs between the services, and tracing helps tie that together.
Yeah, that's for sure.
All right, let's close this out, Tony, with one more thing that I'm not sure how constructive it can be. There probably is some ways, but testing, right?
Yeah, like, that's
you can't definitely... stop your, if you could set up your own Lambda cluster, you might just run that for yourself, right? So
yeah, to some extent you can, right? Like there's a Lambda Docker image that you could run locally and you can do that. But if your Lambda's reaching out to DynamoDB, I guess there's technically a DynamoDB container as well. Like you could, it's a lot of overhead to set this up, but rather than just doing Flask start or whatever the command is to spin up a Flask
start. The go button in my IDE and now it's
yeah, so that's definitely and there's more and more tooling coming out that's coming out for this kind of stuff, but if you can unit test, there's no reason you can't just run unit tests locally. But when you start getting into the integration test, you're probably getting to the point where maybe you just deploy to actual services. It's always trade-offs, right? There's cost associated with it. There's the overhead of how can I deploy to an isolated environment, but maybe it interacts with another microservice. So, So there's definitely trade-offs, but
I can see that you might come up with a QA environment, almost like a mirror image that doesn't share any data, but it's sufficiently close. But then you're running, that's a pretty big commitment because you're running a whole replica of whatever you have.
Right. Yeah. And so, QA environments are great, but you might even want lower than QA. You might want to have a dev or one place I worked at, we would spin up an entire environment for every PR. So could actually, when you created a PR, that environment got spun up and it ran your integration tests and system tests against that environment, which, simulated your prod environment a little bit better than running locally on your machine. So certainly a challenge to test this. And there's always these one-off things too, right? You can't really simulate that memory limitation of a Lambda locally, as much as when you deploy it and things like that. So
That would be much, much harder. Maybe you could run a Docker container and put a memory limit on it. That might work.
Yeah,
but it's
maybe
you're back into more and more DevOps to avoid DevOps.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So there it goes. But interesting. All right. Well, anything else you want to add to this conversation before we wrap it up? About out of time here.
Yeah, I guess I don't know if I have anything. Hopefully we covered enough. There's just a lot of good there's a lot of good resources. The tooling that I've mentioned, Power Tools and Pants, just amazing communities. Power Tools has a Discord, and you can go on there and ask for help, and they're super helpful. Pants has a Slack channel. You can join their Slack and ask, about things. And so those two communities have been really good and really helpful in this. A lot of good talks that are available on YouTube too. So there's definitely resources out there, and that a lot of people have fought this for a while. So
excellent. You don't have to start from just create a function and start typing. Cool. All right, well, before you get out of here though, let's get your recommendation for a PyPI package. Something notable, something fun.
I probably, we've talked a lot about it, but Power Tools is definitely one, that is every day getting used for me. So Power Tools for Lambda and Python, they actually support other languages too. So they have the same functionality for Node.js and, for TypeScript and .NET. And so, but this one definitely, leveraging Power Tools and Pydantic together just really made serverless a lot of fun to write. So definitely doing great things there.
Excellent. Well, I'll put all those things in the show notes. And it's been great to talk to you. Thanks for sharing your journey down the serverless path. Yeah.
Yep. Thanks for having me.
You bet.
Yeah. Enjoy chatting.
Same. Bye.
See ya.
This has been another episode of Talk Python to Me. Thank you to our sponsors. Be sure to check out what they're offering. It really helps support the show. Take some stress out of your life. Get notified immediately about errors and performance issues in your web or mobile applications with Sentry. Just visit talkpython.fm/Sentry and get started for free. And be sure to use the promo code TALKPYTHON, all one word. Mailtrap,
an email delivery platform that developers love. Try for free at mailtrap.io. Want to level up your Python? We have one of the largest catalogs of Python video courses over at TalkPython. Our content ranges from true beginners to deeply advanced topics like memory and async. And best of all, there's not a subscription in sight. Check it out for yourself at training.talkpython.fm. Be sure to subscribe to the show. Open your favorite podcast app and search for Python. We should be right at the top. You can also find the iTunes feed at /iTunes, the Google Play feed at /play, and the direct RSS feed at /RSS on talkpython.fm. We're live streaming most of our recordings these days. If you want to be part of the show and have your comments featured on the air, be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at talkpython.fm/YouTube. This is your host, Michael Kennedy. Thanks so much for listening. I really appreciate it. Now get out there and write some Python code.